I'm going to hand back to James to introduce our first plenary speaker of the week.
Thank you, Pip. Deb Verhoeven is a professor and chair of media and communication at Deakin University in Australia, and has flown an awful long way to be here, so we thank her for that. She was international chair of the 2015 Digital Humanities Conference Programming Committee, and she's a leading proponent of digital humanities in Australia, and is project director of the Humanities Network Infrastructure, HUNI, which I always think is a great, you know, acronym. It's a national research platform that are arts and humanities funded by Nectar, hence why it's called HUNI, national e-research collaboration tools and resources. She served as the inaugural deputy chair of the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia from 2008 to 2011, and as CEO of the Australian Film Institute from 2000 to 2002. She's done all sorts of things, especially with the Australasian Association for Digital Humanities, and so I'd like you to welcome Deb Verhoeven, our first keynote speaker.
Yes, thank you. Indeed, I did travel a very long way to get here, possibly longer than anyone else in this room. I know there's a couple of Australians here, but I came from Melbourne, that's further. There's a theory, a cultural economics theory, that says that you can measure the enthusiasm for attendance by looking at distance traveled as a proxy. On that basis, I am the most enthusiastic person in this room. I'm so glad I'm here. No, really I am. I'm very glad to be here. I want to talk today about this thing, digital infrastructure. Not the most exciting topic you would think, but I want to add some fun into it. So I've done this. See? Did you see that? Watch. I'm going to put some puns into infrastructure. I want to develop a theory of digital infrapuncture, and I'm going to explain what that is, and I'm going to try and get you to help me develop this theory at some point in the course of today's presentation. But I'm going to start by talking about me. This is me. This is a portrait of the contemporary academic. Fragmented, overloaded, torn between different tasks. It's actually a picture of me taken at the High Art Museum in front of a work of art by Anish Kapoor. It's a huge mirror. And I love it because I think it tells a lot about some contemporary issues for academics, not just Celeste, which are the ones that I've just identified. I come from a cinema studies background, so whenever I see an image like this, I'm immediately drawn to the history of women looking in mirrors, which is a motif in films. You would have seen probably millions of these images over the years. Lady from Shanghai is probably one of the most iconic films that features that. But for me, this actually reminds me of a different film which doesn't actually have mirrors in it. It's Being John Malkovich. Do you know that movie?
Yeah.
And he goes inside his own head and he looks through his eyes, and what he sees is himself everywhere, eating dinner, walking around, just everywhere he looks, he just sees himself. And I think this plays to a really interesting issue around intellectual itineraries or challenges in the contemporary world, which is, how do we actually think outside our own heads as academics? How do we get outside our own heads and stop thinking about what we do in terms of projecting ourselves onto the world outside us? How do we make connections based on what we don't already know as scholars? How do we think about making connections to people who aren't the mirror image of ourselves, or to things or objects? So there's a lot going on in this image that I think is really interesting and quite resonant. And I want to think about this in relation now to digital infrastructure. How do we build digital infrastructure that addresses some of those questions, about how to get out from our self-image? Now, the other thing I think about this image, of course, is that it's possibly just a projection of my own jet lag right now. If you ever needed a picture of jet lag, that probably does do it for you. The trip from Australia to the UK is also a one of iconic value. So it's known as the kangaroo route. Has anyone ever heard that? And the reason it was called the kangaroo route, it was developed in the post-war period, is that it used to hop literally all the way to Europe. It would take about 11 days to get from Australia to the UK. And at a certain point, they started to introduce faster jets, less stops, till we get to the lovely position we're in today of it only taking about 30 hours. Don't let me complain anymore. This idea of the distance of Australia from particularly the UK, but Europe in general, is also a motif in a lot of Australian writing. And there's a very famous phrase called the tyranny of distance, that Australia was made from the tyranny of distance. And it's a beautiful quote. The phrase was invented by Geoffrey Blainey, and he says, "Distance is as characteristic of Australia as mountains are of Switzerland. The distance of one part of the Australian coast from another, or the distance of the dry interior from the coast, was a problem as obstinate as Australia's isolation from Europe." Okay. So we're not all isolated from Europe right now, because Australia is in Eurovision. Clearly, Geoffrey Blainey wasn't thinking of that when he wrote that in 1966. And when he was writing in 1966, a number of developments in jet travel occurred, or just prior to that. And that's what I've put up here, this slide. Two pure jets. I'm going to read again another quote. This is a ripper, though. Excuse me. "Almost twice as fast as piston-engined aircraft, these giant jetliners carry you smoothly through the stratosphere in quiet, vibrationless comfort. Despite their enormous speed, you feel no sensation of movement, and you arrive at your destination relaxed, rested, and refreshed, without a trace of travel fatigue." I've never flown in one of these jets, obviously. This is the perfectly pitched promise of infrastructure. Right? This is frictionless movement, purposeful connectedness, a distribution of people, in this instance, that preserves rather than depletes energy, that moves energy around without itself altering the state of what is delivered. It's a vision of infrastructure as a non-evident conduit or a non-evident carrier. And this is the classical way infrastructure is thought of and usually and typically built. I want to rethink this view of infrastructure and also this view of energy. I want to rethink how infrastructure and energy interact. I want to rethink how we best apply our energy in the digital humanities to make digital infrastructure as well. And I want to think this through in terms of a practice-based approach. And this is something you're all, in a sense, going to be engaged in over the next week, is building infrastructure, however small it might be. So I want to have a think about what we think we're doing when we're building that infrastructure and what we think we're building and how we apply ourselves to those tasks. And I want to do that by tracing, to some extent, my own intellectual itinerary. I promise I won't complain about the length of the actual flight. Specifically in relation to two claims that I want to make for infrastructure, and in particular for digital infrastructure, and that is that sense of connection that infrastructure produces, connectivity, is never binary. So I want to park that for a minute. And infrastructure is never neutral. Okay? It does have an impact on what is carried. Those jets leave you wrecked. They don't deliver you in a non-interventionist way to your destination. So I want to rethink that as well. All right. This is a map from the late 1950s, I think, of the kangaroo route. And I've put this up because I want to talk a little bit now about how I came to take an interest in the kangaroo route and how it actually was fundamental to me rethinking some of my ideas around infrastructure. You'll see that Australia was connected to Europe through a largely kind of linear pathway that has nodes in Australia and a node in the UK and then a bunch of stops in between. And those stops are quite interesting and critical to think about. One of those stops is what on this map is called Bombay, or Mumbai. And it figures large in the story I'm about to tell you. If you didn't want to fly Qantas, you could also fly Air India. And this is a beautiful visualization, I think, of the kangaroo route. And again, stopping in Mumbai. And British Airways, BOAC, also flew this same route. And also with a similarly impressive and beautiful visualization. This is what you get now when you try and look up the route to the UK. there is something wrong with visualization. But the most interesting thing about this diagram, which I will quickly digress and explain, is that what you see here is not a linear pathway to Europe, where the nodes at each end are really the network connections, and just a series of stops in between that essentially overlook what's underneath the flight path. The path from Melbourne to London, for example, which stopped 8 times, really treated those underlying countries as just a transit stop, a refuelling stop. So in a sense, Australians, or Qantas in particular, ignored, effectively, Asia, for example. So there's interesting conceptual bases for how these things are worked out. What's going on in this visualisation is a complete change. This is a change that occurred around 2012, so it took that long for them to rethink this. Australia actually now flies into hub networks, so this is much more of a network visualisation of transport. Dubai is the principal one. So the networks, the hubs sit in the middle of the journey now, not at each end, which of course is economically much more efficient, but also means that those places in the centre become something of interest and not to be overlooked. And it does mean that there's a significantly greater number of flights to Asia, for example, from Australia now. Why is this of interest to me? Well, I spent quite a bit of time about 5 to 10 years ago working on diasporic cinema going in Melbourne, particularly cinema going for Greek and Italian migrants who came to Melbourne. And when I started the project, I thought it would be a really straightforward project. There would be about maybe 3 to 4 cinemas. They would have shown some films once a week, maybe twice a week, whatever. 35 cinemas in Melbourne alone just showing Greek films to Greek migrants. 16 Italian cinemas in Melbourne alone showing Italian movies to Italian migrants. Huge, successful entrepreneurial diasporic businesses operating not just in Australia, but delivering films to South Africa, to New Zealand, and around the globe. I had no idea. I was a film historian. I knew a lot about Australian cinema. I had never heard about these circuits. They lasted 30 to 40 years before video really overtook the businesses, and for different reasons they struggled to continue. The Greek business was begun by this guy, Stathis Raftopoulos. Stathis Raftopoulos was also known as Rafto the Magnificent. He was called Rafto the Magnificent because he was not only a cinema entrepreneur, he was a teacher, a prize-winning wrestler, a poet, and an in-demand poet. He performed all the time, including when films broke down. He'd come down the front of the cinema and recite poetry to the audiences. He was also a magician, which is where the name Rafto the Magnificent comes from. A very charismatic man. And he formed an early business called Dionysus Films. And he brought these movies from Greece to Australia, subtitled them here in Australia, or not here, way back there 30 hours ago, in Australia, and built a sustainable business and then merged with his rivals. So he's a really interesting mediating figure. He was able to provide a source of mediation with business rivals, with pre-war and post-war Greek migrants, with Australian culture and Greek culture. And he formed something called Cosmopolitan Pictures with these two other guys. That's where it gets really interesting, because this is about the time the kangaroo route, the late 1950s, becomes affordable for people to begin to fly in and out of Europe. And they start doing that. And they start doing that, and they stop in Mumbai, in Bombay. And while they're in Bombay, because they're all cinephiles, they start watching movies. What movies are they watching? Hindi movies. They meet the stars of the Hindi cinema, and they start to think, wow, I reckon Greek audiences would love these movies. What a great idea. Why don't we show some Hindi movies to Greek audiences? And they did this. This is Mother India. This is the second most popular film on the Greek circuit in Australia. It's an Indian film. They not only did this in Australia, the films also ended up in Greece. Between 1958 and 1964, 111 Hindi movies showed in Athens and Thessaloniki. Okay. They came about because of a seemingly arbitrary or serendipitous coincidence that Qantas had to refuel somewhere in India, and it happened to be Mumbai. those films then change the nature of Greek cinema because they are so popular, the Greek producers can't compete. So they start to introduce music into their movies. 12 songs, usually, with horrendously dripping, terrible film titles, because that's what these films were called. So for example, this one, Mother India, in Greece was titled The Earth Drenched in Sweat. Because my guys, the guys in Melbourne, were cinephiles, they kept the original titles, which is kind of nice. This is not an isolated incident either, so I don't mean to kind of suggest that this is some claim for Cosmopolitan Pictures. In fact, Lebanese distributors were taking Hindi films into Nigeria in the same period and so on. So what we start to see is a much less binary and a much more kind of radial or lateral set of movements coming about as we perform a type of cultural infrastructure. And this all comes about because of other infrastructures, interrelated or overlapping ones, like transport networks. Okay. So, this is just a little list of some of the films that screened in Australia and when. That's one set of things I want to talk about in relation to infrastructure. The other thing I learned about infrastructure from doing this project on Greek cinema is this. This is really interesting. This is where we tried to map the location of the cinemas against Greek migrant population. So what we did first is we got the census years, worked out how many migrants there were, figured out where they were living precisely according to suburb or administrative region, and then we overlaid that onto a map with cinemas, and they were static maps for each census year. Pretty straightforward. Yes, the cinemas appeared where there were migrants. All very straightforward. Until I decided what we actually should do is animate it so we can get a sense of progression through time. And this is what happened. I'll let you just look at it for a sec. So the darker the area, the more Greeks. Okay, so I've looked at this about 7 million times, so I'm going to quickly cut to the chase. As one does with a movie, spoiler alert. The spoiler here is the cinemas precede populations and they leave before populations disperse. All right, they are like harbingers of what's going on in the community. This is counterintuitive and enormously interesting. Okay, because what it's telling us is that cultural infrastructure, like cinemas, is a catalyzer. It catalyzes communities. If you build it, hey, they actually come. I've done it, I've proven the unprovable theory. I don't even know where to begin with a piece of information like this other than what I've done with it, which is to sit down and actually rethink what I think about infrastructure. Okay. Infrastructure is not neutral, right? Infrastructure catalyzes. And I want us to kind of take this through the next week and think about that as we start to build infrastructure. So, just to quickly summarize, what is infrastructure? Infrastructure creates the conditions of possibility for connection. It can be physical, institutional, organizational, and methodological. Okay, I'm going to run that again. Physical, institutional, organizational, and methodological. Infrastructure marks, separates, connects, and ranks human difference. It distributes difference at the same time that it makes those connections, that creates the possibilities for those connections. It's not a passive conduit. It catalyzes, for better or worse. In that sense, it's a technology that holds a social promise. Not just a technical one, a social promise. And I think the other thing to think about in relation to infrastructure that I do want to emphasize and that I want to kind of move on to now as we sort of start to move into the concluding parts of the talk is infrastructure is always reparative. It's always in the mode of repair. Okay? Infrastructure identifies that something needs to be put back together. Put together, put back together. And that's, I really want us to think about this, particularly in the current political climate, a post-Brexit world, a post-Australian election world. What do we think about in terms of that reparative gesture, that gesture towards repair, in terms of what we're doing with building digital infrastructure? Digital humanities infrastructure has come in for quite a bit of criticism recently. I don't know if anyone's been following the trolling in the LA Review of Books that we've received. It's fun, not. There seems to be a sort of debate around digital humanities infrastructure, which where there's sort of two positions of criticism. The first is that it goes something like, DH requires large-scale resources and has therefore created a division in the humanities, and therefore DH must be neoliberal, simply because we use up a lot of resource. And the other is that large-scale digital infrastructure in the humanities is a folly, and that we should return to small-scale, closer, and more human practices in the digital humanities. That's where we should be located. I'm going to argue, obviously, against both those positions. I think we want to preserve a place for humanities infrastructure or digital humanities infrastructure that acknowledges the potency and importance of the specific and the situated without leaving aside the world. Okay? I want to make an appeal for us to be thinking about the world in everything we do. I want a sort of a middle-level theory of digital humanities infrastructure situated somewhere between the big thinking of the world and the situated and the local, which is very important to the humanities and it's very important to us as humans. I do argue this very deliberately in the context of Brexit and in the context of widening polarisations around the world, in the context of arguments for isolationism and the systemic political exile of millions of refugees. I argue this because I believe where infrastructure is concerned, that the digital humanities needs to propose a theory or theories of the world, of world making, of world sensing, if we are to matter. I argue this because I believe that we need a theory of the world in everything we do as we build digital humanities infrastructure, no matter how small that effort may seem to us. Before you touch a keyboard, before you fill out a funding application, before you step into the classroom, reflect on what kind of world you believe you're in. What kind of coexistence do you live? Are you going to be making infrastructure for an irrevocably broken world? In other words, are you going to be building palliative infrastructure? Is your infrastructure oriented to being palliative? Will you be building infrastructure for an unfinished world? In which case, your infrastructure will be additive, adding more, trying to come to some sense of conclusion or completion. Are you building infrastructure for a dynamic world? In which case, you will need an adaptive infrastructure. Infrastructure oriented to adaption. Will you be building infrastructure for a post-factual world, which apparently we find ourselves in now? Then perhaps we need an infrastructure that builds better dreams and better narratives. We might need to build digital archives that focus on interpretive acts of remembering, that don't focus on how things looked, for example, but focus on how the look felt to someone. Will you be building infrastructure for an increasingly divergent and divisive world? In which case you want to think about a different kind of connective infrastructure than the infrastructure we currently have, because clearly it's not working. Flip through a bit. The one I'm most exercised about at the moment is how do we build infrastructure for a collapsing world? A world of systemic collapse. Maybe it's the Anthropocene, maybe it's a post-Brexit world, a world that can't just be fixed or put back together by replacing one system with another system. What we need to think about is a critical or hybrid approach to overhauling the actual structure in infrastructure. Okay? infra, beneath, structure to build. I think we've done a lot of work on the beneath, on trying to get voices from below to speak through our infrastructure. What we haven't really done is sat down to think about the structure side of infrastructure. And that's why I want to talk about something like infrapuncture, to remove that sense of the build, the structure, the new system, and to try and think about how we think differently about systems themselves. I was going to talk about Honey, but we're going to run out of time, so I'm going to skip through Honey. But Honey is an infrastructure where we tried or attempted some of these ideas to rethink the speaking from below component, the inclusive component, but it moved on from being about inclusion to also being about involvement. So not just including new voices in our infrastructure, but in fact involving those people in the building of the infrastructure, which is also an effect of the infrastructure. So this is infrastructure, Honey is infrastructure about infrastructure. So it's a federated discovery service in which researchers build the ontologies using their own words. Skipping. This is what a scientist did inside Honey. They built a virtual collection that looked like this. It actually broke Honey, because we didn't actually think anyone would do this. Because usually what humanities researchers do is this, which looks a little bit more like the kangaroo route when you think about it. These are two collections. That's my collection about a filmmaker called Ken Hall. And this is a collection that another researcher built on her research topic, which was on fashion in Australia, in Australian literature and cinema. And unbeknownst to the both of us, our two collections connected through the links or connections that we provided and described in our own words. And this enabled us to, in a sense, produce a kind of serendipity, where by looking at my collection and travelling along the links that I had produced in order for my collection to make sense, my world, I was serendipitously connected to Michelle's collection. So it kind of reproduces a browsing pathway that you might have had once when you walked through a library. You can now do this in a digital environment. But for that to work, the researchers have to give up their knowledge publicly and produce these links between records inside Honey and describe them and connect to other researchers. But that's all I want to say about Honey, because we're going to move right on to infrapuncture, a new model for digital humanities infrastructure. There's been quite a lot of discussion in the digital humanities about the need to reconsider digital infrastructure in terms of capacity and care. Bethany Nowiski has written a couple of really influential blog posts around this, which I recommend you to read. What I think is really interesting in this discussion is that the underlying insistence on an infrastructure of care is that we all need to develop an appreciation for where it hurts in society or in our infrastructure, in our research fields or whatever, to have a sense of the pain in the social worlds that we inhabit or the intellectual communities. And I think that is important. I don't mean to suggest there's anything to be critical about in that concern. But I do think we need a complementary approach as well, which enables us to understand how to amend the systemic causes of that pain. Okay? It's not just enough to recognise that the pain's there. We actually have to get at why it's there and what's producing it. And I don't think we do that enough in relation to the infrastructure that we build. So an orientation to care is important, particularly as a preventative mechanism. But where there are already evident symptoms of pain and stress, we need a way to think holistically about what a better version of infrastructure would be that could intervene at critical locations in relation to that. And that brings me to infrapuncture. So infrapuncture obviously is a combined term, infrastructure and acupuncture, if you didn't get that from the first slide. It's a way of thinking about how small-scale infrastructure interventions can transform larger contexts. It's, as in the practice of acupuncture, aimed at relieving stress, to relieve systemic pressure in a digital ecology, for example. And it's loosely based on Manuel de Sola Morales' theory of urban acupuncture, which has been used and played out quite a bit now in urban design and urban policy. Okay, so let's have a look at some of the features of Infrapuncture. I'm going to run through a list. It's a sort of money shot slide that all keynote speakers hate because it's really texty, and you're just going to sit there staring at it and you won't be looking at me, which, you know, disturbs me greatly. On the other hand, there's going to be a lot of content coming through, and I do want you to read it, because what I want to do at the end of the list is I want to ask you to contribute some more, okay? I want to break through, in a sense, the infrastructure of keynote speaking, where I stand up the front and tell you how it all is, and I don't actually listen to what I'm saying, because what I'm saying is I actually want this to be an engagement where you actually have a voice as well, right? So let's spin through this. I know it's going to kind of feel a little tedious, but see how we go. Okay, so here are some of the assumptions underlying infrapuncture or an infrapuncture approach. That we understand that the work we do is social in nature. I think we've covered that pretty clearly. This one, that universities aren't monopolies on knowledge. Again, this is reasonably well accepted in theory, rarely in practice in terms of what we do. Even when we're crowdsourcing. Crowdsourcing is the worst at this, right? Because what crowdsourcing essentially mostly does is it collects content from the public, but preserves knowledge and analysis to the expert. Okay. Pretty much every crowdsourcing system I've ever seen does that, perhaps with the exception of Honey, which actually hands expertise over to the public. This one's important. When we approach infrapuncture, we're approaching it from within circuits of action and reaction, from the middle, and we're coming at things from a slant, from sideways, as it were. We're not assuming there's a neat beginning, middle, and end that we control in some teleological or progressive sense. We're part of the infrastructure we build, and that's also very, very critical to understand. If that hasn't made sense yet, it might in a minute. Okay, infrapuncture doesn't assume your infrastructure will live forever, a major folly in the building of most infrastructure. All right, so my challenge to you now, and I want to sort of spend maybe 5 minutes on this, is what else might infrapuncture look like? What other ways could we rethink the current systems we build, either as digital humanists or in other fields that you might be involved in? Have a think about it. I'm actually going to leave you some time to think, and then I'm going to ask you to tell me something. I'm going to put these slides up in SlideShare, so we're all good. Any thoughts? Has anyone had any ideas about how they can rethink what they do in terms of the infrastructures they work with? I can think of a couple. I mean, I think I ran out of screen space, but I mean, I could probably keep listing things. I think it's important that whatever infrastructure we build is open, sourced, and in fact interoperable. So that sense of being in the middle of things also means being able to connect to other infrastructure or be open to that. So that was one I missed out on. Any others? I'll go on. I know it's 9 in the morning. No, it's 10. Who didn't have coffee today? Yes. Yes.
Big companies like Google, but like big projects like Wikipedia, so this is happening right now. So, yep. You know, honestly,
Oh, I love that.
This is a thing that is leading now the station, you know, we lose it.
Urgency, I think that's brilliant. I'd love to add that to the list.
I think it's also important to be aware of who's allowed to build the infrastructure. Particularly in academia, there's not a lot of space for, say, graduate students to build infrastructure, but often it's really important to find ways of making that space, because being able to build infrastructure is such good training.
That's a brilliant point, yes, and it's not on the list, which is the who. I think that's fantastic. Any other thoughts about... Yes.
Infrastructure has an aesthetic.
Yeah. We saw that really painfully with the Dubai London thing. Absolutely. And I think that aesthetics can mean many things. You know, so there's the sense of how we design the interfaces or engagements with our infrastructure is critical. Generative interface design, I think, would fit really nicely with something like infrapuncture. Some of you may be familiar with Mitchell Whitelaw's work on generous interface design. We use that as the basis for the Honey interface and user experience. That's a very great point, which is, not just think of infrastructure as what's under the hood, but that moment of engagement. Absolutely. I'm going to move on with my conclusion. So thank you, everyone, for helping out with that. We must, in everything we do, address and redress the deepening divisions that mark this world's version of humanity. Not just by focusing on the connections between things and us, but we have to cooperate and co-produce an alternative version of the present. And this gets to the point of urgency. This is not about building infrastructure for the future. This is about addressing now and rebuilding how we live now, the vision of how we live now. I think too often we behave as if we believe deep down that our actions have no real effect. Let's face it, we're not curing cancer. I haven't anyway. We're not finding new habitable planets to live on after we trash this one. So as scholars, and I think particularly as humanities scholars, but even as humans, I think we have to remember and hang on to the fact that we do matter. Okay, we do have an impact. We make a difference. So let's design information infrastructure that takes that as a given, that understands and deals with our impact on the world, and does that with an ethics and a social sensitivity. How do we imagine an information infrastructure, a digital information infrastructure, in which agency, impact, and power are the key conceptual axes? Who has it? And this gets to the point about who gets to make it. Who has power? Who wields power? What affordances do we provide for it? What protections are in there? How do we think about that? If we rethink infrastructure in terms of impact and away from the convention, the Qantas jetliner mythology of frictionless, non-impactful movement between things, if we flip that around and think about the impact, it changes the ways in which we ethically handle our relationships within infrastructure and with infrastructure. We need to move on from connection to collaboration and cooperation. But it's not just about making. It's not just about making a difference. It's also about being open ourselves to change. Infrapuncture is not just what we do, it's what's done to us. Right? If I've given you the impression today that my own intellectual itinerary from one place to another was somehow smooth and frictionless and didn't involve lost arguments, paths not taken, leaps of faith and serendipity, conflict and contestation, then I've done you a disservice. Okay? All that's in there. And there have been, within all of that, gleanings. Not me moving from a place of less information to a more capacious, spacious, knowledgeable future of myself. Gleanings, inklings. Working on the Greek film circuit, for example, taught me that infrastructure is as much about acknowledging and connecting the fragments within us as well as connecting to those who are both like us and unlike us. I like to think that the digital infrastructure I build makes a difference, and I have got the user evaluations that tell me this, so phew. But just as importantly, I want to recognise that making digital infrastructure changed me. It changed the way I think about my agency. It helped me understand my own limitations, my intellectual resiliences, and my unrealised capacity for interconnection and cooperation. Okay. It changed my self-definition as an academic. I never was much of an academic as expert. Imposter syndrome, whatever. I never was, although I wanted to be, an academic as mediator, the Thomas Osborne's wonderful reconceptualization of what the academic is in the late 20th century. I want to be an academic as a catalyzer. That's the kind of academic I want to be, and I think we can all be. So I wish, in the most heartfelt way, that you also touch on some of these experiences during the remainder of this week, that you allow yourselves to be open to the idea that what you do here at Oxford this week will change you and will embolden you to believe that what you do, and in particular the way that you do it, I'm going to give you a pun alert here, okay? The way you conduct yourself can make a difference. Thank you.